Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to be talking about all kinds of cool science. In fact, I want to name this show Amazing Molecules, because that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about organoids. Some sort of sounds a little bit like a 90s punk rock group, the organoids, but actually organoids are artificial organs built of stem cells. And we've been working on that. I've been following this for, oh goodness, at least a decade and bringing you the latest technology here. This comes from École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne. Sorry, I had to do that. And it is about this cutting-edge tool of the modern life sciences. The idea here is to use stem cells and build miniature versions of the organ that accurately resemble and behave like their counterparts. Now, there's a lot of bogus stem cell stuff out there, and there's a lot of not-so-bogus stem cell stuff out there, and this one falls into the actually not bogus category. Stem cells have remarkable potential, but organoids especially, because among other things, we could get away from animal testing, which as we move towards being ascended human beings, it starts to feel less and less okay to torture animals to prove that drugs are safe and effective. It'll also potentially, eventually, allow us to grow healthy human organs and replace diseased ones. But that's a long way from here. However, an important next step has been made. Organoid technology is still in its infancy. And the problem was, we thought we could just, like, take a bunch of stem cells out of the placenta and inject them into the joint. And, you know, they just knew what they were supposed to do, go make cartilage. And while there is some contextual signaling that's taking place, there is a lot that the stem cells don't know and don't necessarily do as we'd like. Typically, if you just throw them into the body, what you get is a circular closed tissue, kind of like a balloon. This isn't an organ, and it doesn't have, and it has a short lifespan. Often it grows very large or stays very small, and the shape is wrong, and it doesn't have much in the way of anatomic or physiological consistency with real life organs. This group at EPFL is looking at guiding stem cells, and they've been working for several years to build an intestinal organoid that looks and functions like real tissue. This was just published recently in Nature. And the method exploits the way that stem cells can grow and organize themselves if you give them a scaffolding. So the researchers created a scaffolding and they placed it inside a microfluidic chip. They did this because they want to be able to communicate using tiny little channels in the chip to put little bits of fluid at exactly certain points along the organoid, effectively acting like an artificial nervous system to get the thing to act like a gut. They also created a scaffold inside a hydrogel. So the scaffolding is, well, just basically like a mold for the cells to grow along. The hydrogel is a goo of cross-linked proteins that supports the cells just like the cells are supported in native tissue. This hydrogel provides a form or a geometry, and the scaffolding provides the shape. And between the two of them, once you seed the stem cells, within hours, they start spreading along the scaffolding. They form a continuous layer of cells, and they start to create crypts and villi, the little holes and the little outpouchings that are normally seen in intestinal cells. And this is the surprise. Once you gave the stem cells the structure, without any additional chemical signaling, the stem cells themselves knew how to arrange themselves to form a functional tiny gut. The geometry of the scaffold unlocked the information in the DNA of the stem cells, telling them which genes to use, such that the stem cells that were in the crypt shaped cavities remain stem cells. The ones that were on the areas outside, particularly in the villi, differentiated into mucus-producing cells, just like in a real gut. They, in fact, produced all of the differentiated cell types found in the real gut, including some rare and specialized types that you just don't usually get organoids to form. This is really interesting because these miniature intestines are able to regenerate just like the gut can regenerate, and we can use them to model inflammatory processes. We can look at gut and microbiome signaling in these organoids in a way that couldn't be possible in an animal model, because in this way we'll be able to isolate individual variables, impossible to do in an actual animal. So we are looking at a whole new playground for disease modeling, drug discovery, diagnostics, and regenerative medicine. And I'm happy to bring you this story. I look forward to telling you more about stem cells, organoids, and the future of regenerative medicine. I think it's a very bright future. Well, that was at the macroscopic level. These things are about the size of a matchstick. Now let's go deeper down to the nano to micro level interface and talk about something called DNA origami. DNA is a very, very interesting substance because it spontaneously forms from a monofilament, a single chain of nucleotides, into a double helix. And it does that spontaneously when you have dissociated DNA and you just drop it into a room temperature vial and let the Brownian motion bumps them into each other, and they find a way to self-structure to create that DNA helix. But they're very sticky little molecules. I'm thinking of like the colored pipe cleaners that I used to get back in grade school that we would make things out of, except these colored pipe cleaners can be used to build structures not at the nano level where DNA lives, but at the micro level. So we can get to micron to millimeter sized DNA structures, which have amazing potential. These are micron sized structures. So let's just, for the sake of giving you some scale, a red blood cell is 7 microns across. So 1/7 of a red blood cell is a micron. And when you take these strings of single-stranded DNA and aggregate them, it's a little bit like twisting wool, okay? Anyone who's ever seen someone spin wool or spin silk, you have these biological fibers, which are very thin, and when you put them together in parallel and rotate them, they attach to each other, and you get not just double helixes, but you get, among other things, a six-fold structure, 6 double helixes. And when you rotate that, you can get to something that's about the width of a human hair, something you could see with your naked eye that's made entirely out of DNA. But if we keep that structure small, it's amazing what kind of shapes. You can take small little fragments of single-strand DNA and use them as if you were working with Tinker Toys. Now, I'm dating myself when I talk about Tinker Toys, but these were structures with sticks and wheels, and you could use the hubs or the wheels to make hubs. You could spin them on their central axis because they had a hole. You could have you could build a merry-go-round with these things. I really enjoyed my Tinker Toys, and I'm visualizing Tinker Toys now as I looked to the description of meta-multi-arm junctions, 3D polyhedrons, and 2 and 3D lattices. They were able to actually transfer the dynamic features of DNA into the meta-DNA. In other words, think of it like micro pipe cleaners and being made into macro pipe cleaners, but the quality, the physical features and abilities of the pipe cleaners doesn't change in the process. So far, they have been able to build, with these little short meta junctions, they've been able to build tetrahedrons, octahedrons, prisms, and 6 different types of closely packed lattices, which could have all kinds of uses, including circuitry. Yeah, circuits. A little bit of microfluidics with a conductive fluid. And hey, you've got a micron circuit, a micron transistor, a micron chip, molecular motors, nano devices that could get down there next to the red blood cell and operate on it, or maybe change it, or maybe fix it. These things, because they could be reconfigurable on stimulation, you could cause a physical conformation change, maybe fixing sickle cell by unsickling the cells and eliminating sickle cell crisis rather than it having to be something that a person suffers through. There's all sorts of amazing possibilities here. I think it was a Nova on origami that looked at macro and micro origami. And one of the things I remember from that was watching on big solar collection array that was folded into a tiny little capsule and sent up into space. And it's very similar to the way that flowers are structured inside the bud before they bloom. This type of geometry, the origami geometry, is going to be working not just in orbit, but inside us sometime in the not too distant future. Well, we're going to move to the drug level. So I guess we're still at a molecular level. We're playing powers of 10 tonight, I guess. And we're going to talk about a couple of new clinical trials using a compound called low-dose naltrexone. Naltrexone is a very interesting molecule. You'll have heard of Narcan. And Narcan is a naloxone, and it's the injectable version. Naltrexone is its first cousin that is an oral agent. And it's FDA approved at a dose of 50 milligrams a day to be used for treatment of alcoholism and other substance abuse disorders. At that level, it's known to reduce cravings. But naltrexone has some really fascinating properties at a tenth of that dose. It's been shown to have a profound effect on the inflammatory cycle. It reduces the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines, especially interleukin 6 and tumor necrosis alpha. And these effects are independent of its effect on opiate receptors, because, of course, it does also attach to opiate receptors. So like many drugs, it has multiple effects, but when you give a large dose, you don't necessarily get the immune effects. That only happens at small doses, which is sort of an interesting phenomenon. One trial that I just learned about is being sponsored by the National Institute of Arthritis and Musculoskeletal Skin Diseases. And what this trial does is it's looking at vasculitis. Vasculitis is an extremely uncomfortable autoimmune condition in which the linings of the blood vessels become inflamed. People who have this have essentially diffuse body inflammation. They walk around feeling like they've got the flu all the time. They also have painful rashes and sometimes very disfiguring skin symptoms. They often have sleep apnea and depression, and treatment of vasculitis is an important goal. In a recently approved FDA study, they're going to give 4.5 milligrams of naltrexone daily to see if they can help with vasculitis. There's already published research showing that, and these are blinded, placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized trials, so it's, you know, good science, that it works in fibromyalgia, that it works in the gastrointestinal symptoms of Crohn's, and that it is helpful in multiple sclerosis. In fact, I have several multiple sclerosis patients over the years that I've used this in with apparently good effects. I mean, I'm not being blinded. I'm not being a scientist here. I'm being a clinician, and I think it worked. So there's also some evidence that it may work in the central nervous system. So that's perhaps why fibromyalgia, which is a central nervous system pain processing issue, that's why it may be effective there. It's also been shown to have mitigation in the inflammatory roles of brain microglia. The microglia are the cells that have been implicated in Alzheimer's disease. So wouldn't it be great if a safe, low, once-a-day dose of something reduced pain helped the brain and kept you from going insane? Oh, it would be fantastic. And I'm happy to see this study going forward. And while I was searching around looking for what was cooking with naltrexone, I also came across this study where because COVID, right? There was a book a while back called Because Internet. Well, I think now we have to say because COVID. And I want cred here. We went 20 minutes without saying the C word, so give me some credit. But we're really talking about LDN. This study is looking at giving LDN early in with people who are infected, who have just an early viral response where they're a little bit sick, giving them LDN to help prevent them from progressing into the late pulmonary effect stage. This sounds like a really good idea because we know that that progression is mediated by the production of interleukin 6 and tumor necrosis alpha. It also blocks the toll-like receptor, which is a very, very strong pro-inflammatory receptor that's responsible for why people with leaky gut can get a lot of body aches. That toll-like receptor is everywhere, and it's pro-inflammatory. And in the case of leaky gut, little bits of bacteria, wall fragments, get across that leaky gut and go and attach to the toll-like receptors and trigger an inflammatory response. It also perpetuates autoimmune disease, which is why I'm such an advocate of cleaning up your microbiome if you've got autoimmune disease. To get back to the study, they're going to use the low-dose naltrexone early in people who present with COVID, and they're going to have a backup plan, which is ketamine. Ketamine at low doses rapidly reduces the production of pro-inflammatory cytokines, also IL-6 and tumor necrosis factor, and it happens for hours after it's given IV. This is not a drug we'd be able to give in the community, but the nice thing about ketamine is there's a lot of it around. It's generally well-tolerated, and it's approved for immediate use in humans. It's used as an anesthetic. So sub-anesthetic dose, you effectively anesthetize the viral cytokine storm. Sounds like a great hypothesis. I'm glad to see that this study has funding and it is enrolling now. So hopefully we will have some preliminary data on this by, well, usually these things take about 6 months. And let's see, this was started in April 29th. They're still in the recruiting phase, but they're definitely already running their study. So exciting news, and I'll keep you posted on the low-dose naltrexone. But while we're talking about this, if you have an inflammatory disorder, if you've been diagnosed with something that's requiring low doses of prednisone or one of the anti-tumor necrosis alpha drugs like Remicade, you might consider asking your doctor to use this. This is something that has some enough science, I think, that you might be able to find a doctor who would prescribe it for you. And if you have a rheumatologist, I'd love you to get in their face and make them read the literature on this because I can't. But maybe the patients can. So there is a good, solid literature. I think we need to start introducing this into conventional medicine. But that's going to take a push. So help me out if you can, folks. We're going to go to an email. This was just a heads up from one of my regular emailers, Pat, who sent a link to an article about face masks maybe helping people get immune to COVID. That sounds paradoxical. So I'll tell you all about that. Thanks, Pat, for bringing this to my attention. This was a commentary, not a study, basically an editorial, published in the recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. I think it was last week's issue. And the idea was that universal mask wearing could become a form of what they're calling variolation, inoculation, in other words, that would generate immunity. Recent research has shown that you can get a strong immune response even from a mild or asymptomatic coronavirus infection. And the idea that when you are wearing a mask, you might be getting a few virus particles in, but not enough to make you sick. We know now, and it was a good bet from the start, but now we have the data, that the amount of virus someone gets exposed to at the start of the infection, the inoculum or infectious dose, is often correlated with how severe the illness is. It makes sense. The thing is a race between you and your immune system and the virus and its ability to hijack your cells and reproduce. So it makes sense that the more virus that gets rolling at the same time, the more workload for your immune system. It's sort of like in back in the old days of infantry. If they pour troops at you, it's kind of hard to defend. There was a natural experiment which occurred on an Argentinian cruise ship where passengers were all given surgical masks when COVID broke out. The staff were given N95 masks. And the rate of asymptomatic infection when they finally let the people off the ship and tested them was 81% with antibodies. In the earlier cruise ship outbreaks, without universal masking, the rate of asymptomatic infection was only 20% because people got sicker. That's what we call an N of one event, and we need more data, and it's going to be a little hard to get. What we'd like to do would be to do a study looking at specific T-cell immunity, because that would seem to be the thing that asymptomatic infection is most likely to generate rather than a high antibody titer. And in fact, we are seeing that T-cell immunity is a thing, and it does happen. So it's an extremely interesting set of natural experiments which are taking place. Pat, what I think about this when I ask myself is, you know, I've been very good about masking, and I've had, probably an exemplary record of putting the damn thing on. I do see a great deal of natural variation in the population as I walk around, but I think if you just stay 6 feet apart, might even be 3 feet. The French are doing 3 feet now, but let's 1 meter, but let's say 6 feet apart with any kind of mask is a very, very good level of protection. And social distancing is hugely beneficial. I've got another story about that we may get to today, but I'm trying to go on a COVID diet. And we do have a caller. So this is Aline.
Ow, like Alice. It's French, but I'm not.
Okay. Hello,
doctor.
Hi, Aline.
Yeah, I'm making a follow-up call. I wanted to confirm I have the jar in my hand. We talked about osteoporosis and calcium. I'm taking calcium 600 mg and vitamin D3 over the counter. And so if I take two, that's 1,200. And then I was reading an article, back issues of a woman's health news. I can't remember where. I can't find the addresses to where they're out of. But there may be direct correlation between taking calcium supplements and forming kidney stones.
Yes, most of the kidney stones that one makes have calcium in them. However, people have to have a tendency to form kidney stones, and they have to be also basically be dehydrated. Kidney stones actually probably have something to do with the microbiome of the kidney. Did you know that the kidney had a microbiome?
No.
And we think now that certain bacteria gather calcium around themselves, and that this allows for the accretion and accumulation of the calcium. Rather like if you have ever lived in a house with hard water and you get that crusty stuff around the faucet, just like that. Or, you know, like plaque forms on your teeth. Plaque is calcium. It's attracted to the bacteria, and the bacteria attract the calcium because it helps them build a little bacteria house, which protects them from physical trauma like brushing your teeth. See how it all fits together?
Indeed.
Anyway,
Well, so
let me just talk. Let me riff for a second on calcium. I recommend, and I think the data supports me, if you can absorb dietary calcium, it's better. I recommend keeping the dose of calcium at any given moment to 500 milligrams or less. So you don't want to take 1,000 or 1,200 at once. I recommend that you take an equal amount of magnesium,
Right.
And that you get some vitamin K2, particularly a type called MK7, because vitamin K2 is like a, you remember, like an old time railroad switch. And so if vitamin K2 is present, the calcium is going to go preferentially into the bone. If vitamin K2 is absent, the calcium is actually going to float around in the bloodstream and end up potentially in the arteries. So if you take too much calcium, yes, statistically, you do get an increased risk of calcium stones. But more importantly, we're all taking calcium because we want to protect our bones. And it doesn't work unless you have adequate vitamin D levels in your blood, which you should have checked annually. And right now, with you know what running around, we are that the disease which shall not be named, and I don't mean the president, sorry, let me be specific. I mean the virus. But anyway, the thing is, this is a moment when we want a lot of vitamin D in our system. Levels of 35 to and above, I'd shoot for 40, are helpful in the immune system, and they are also beneficial for the bones. So it's a win-win proposition. And I found when I started taking vitamin D that I also got a lot less achy than I had been before. And I started doing this in my early 40s. So I'm pretty convinced that this is a good thing to be doing, and I encourage everyone to do it. So equal amounts of magnesium and calcium, 600 a day, 800 a day, maybe
but
even
not
1,000.
More than, not the 1,000 to 1,500 or so.
No,
another
no,
article here mentions the calcium absorption after 25. Unabsorbed calcium can lead to arthritis and heart disease.
Well, if it's unabsorbed, I don't see how it can lead to arthritis and heart disease, but that's just probably bad headline writing.
Right. Well, it's in an article.
The heart disease connection is related to calcium getting into plaque.
Oh.
So-called hardening of the arteries, a term your grandma might have used. And yes, it's a thing. And that hardening of the arteries isn't just calcium. It's calcium in plaque, makes the plaque stiff. And then the stiff plaque, well, the blood vessel wall isn't elastic anymore, so you get high blood pressure. So that's problem number one. And then the high blood pressure injures the inside of the blood vessels, so they scab, and a blood vessel scab is called an arterial sclerotic plaque. They're basically an attempt to heal and callus over an area that's being subject to repeated trauma.
Indeed. Oh, and doctor, I'm going tomorrow to pick up my GP's referral to get the bone density test.
Excellent.
I had one some years ago.
Well, I hope that your bones have remained stable, and I will tell you, take your scores when you get them, and go and Google Frax, FRAX. And what will come up is the University of Sheffield, and they have a tool called the Frax Calculator, and it asks you a bunch of questions, and then it gives you a statistical calculation based on the United States population. You have to collect the United States box, and it does control for ethnicity, and it tells you what your risk, your 10-year risk of a major fracture is. And that helps us decide whether or not the risk-benefit ratio favors using one of these bisphosphonate agents or one of the other, maybe Evista, which is raloxifene, or one of the other anti-osteoporosis drugs.
Mm. Well, speaking of osteoporosis, I found an old article that Izurex enlarged to keep along with giving to my doctor, and she is a woman who's a doctor of chiropractic, but nonetheless, she seems to know about osteoporosis, or, yeah, they should in that practice. And the contributing factors, sugar intake, caffeine intake, well, I don't drink coffee, soft drinks, no, dieting and staying too thin, no, high protein diets, no, I do a Mediterranean diet and fresh everything, sedentary lifestyle.
Did she mention genetics?
No.
Okay, that's a big factor. So whether your grandmother or any of your auntie had that spinal curvature when they got old,
Well, I come from healthy genes, fortunately, and I have my father's mother's grandmother's genes.
Well, you have a few more than that, but that's good.
Well, yeah.
Did you have any follow-up questions?
Well, I guess that's it, and
keep listening, my love.
I'll keep listening. It's just that I know that a lot of people, more and more people start listening, and I'll tell them to tune in for all of us who used to listen to and love Dr. Dean Adel.
Well, you
retired
most...
10 years ago.
I know, but he was definitely an inspiration to me way back in medical school. And look where I ended up. Not quite
Indeed.
As rich, not quite as famous, but just as happy.
Well,
all right.
We'll get there.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Thank
all
you.
Right. Bye-bye for now. You're welcome.
I think we have time to tackle this topic. We're going to talk about muscle aging now. This is and we're also going to be talking about a compound called rapamycin, which has a very interesting history and turns out to have its fingers in a lot of pots. Okay, so researchers at the University of Basel's Biozentrum, I think that means biocenter, have demonstrated that a well-known drug, that is to say rapamycin, can delay the progression of age-related muscle weakness. Even in midlife, our muscles begin to shrink and we begin to lose strength. This is a natural part of aging, but in some people, it can be a very rapid change. It can lead to something called sarcopenia. And this is something I've been testing people for in my medical practice now for easily 15 years. Sarcopenia is inadequate muscle mass. If you stop and think about it, if you're 5'5", you've got probably about the same amount of blood as most other 5'5" tall people, and you've probably got about the same amount of skeleton and about the same amount of most things, but the only thing that really varies is muscle. In sarcopenia, people become weak and their metabolism actually shifts, so they have less energy. Because they have less muscle, they are much more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. And in fact, one of the best ways to avoid type 2 diabetes, if you have a genetic tendency, or you had, for example, gestational diabetes when you were pregnant, is maintain your muscle mass. Weightlifting or resistance exercise is a specific against the development of diabetes, because those extra muscles you've got, they just suck in the sugar whenever it's in your bloodstream. So you don't get high blood sugar. And it's high blood sugar leads to high insulin, and high insulin leads to insulin resistance. So you can stop that thing and nip it in the bud by just keeping your muscle mass. Now, there's lots of reasons people get sarcopenia, but signaling by something called the mTOR pathway contributes to sarcopenia, and you can suppress this. Well, we know there's two things that can suppress it. One of them is the well-known drug rapamycin, and we've already mentioned exercise. If you give low-dose rapamycin to mice, you get an overwhelmingly beneficial effect in that their muscles don't age. They do not develop age-related sarcopenia, and they maintain their muscle mass. This research is, you know, solid rat work, so shall we say they're using mice, but it underlines that there may be drugs out there that we already have that are already in existence that could be repurposed for this use. Now, what is rapamycin anyway? Let's start back in 1992. In 1992, there was a doctor named David Sabatini who was at Johns Hopkins Medical School, and he discovered a protein called, now it's called mTOR. And by the way, mTOR, it's a funny name, it's the initials for mammalian target of rapamycin. They would look at this and try to understand what this protein did, and what they found was that it acted on a piece of DNA that influences something called the sirtuin pathway, or this SIRT gene. And the SIRT gene, among other things, is responsible for keeping those telomeres long. And what else affects or turns on F-A-S-T-I-R-T, fasting. So in a weird way, calorie restriction, not really fasting so much as keeping those calories to about 80% of what your metabolism would demand, paradoxically extends your life. Brings us back to the Blue Zone books, right? Let's see, how did it go? Eat half, walk double, and love much, I believe, was the old saying. I think that's from Okinawa, if I'm not mistaken. But the idea is good social connections, don't overeat, and get your exercise, and you can live to be 100. Doesn't take much. Of course, we're always looking for a pill to do it. And in fact, rapamycin has been, shall we say, weaponized. The mTOR pathway basically signals your body to demolish parts of the old cells and recycle them into newer, healthier cells. So it stimulates the development of new cells. Read new muscle cells in the case of the work on the mice and their muscles. Rapamycin essentially tricks the body into thinking that it's in a state of calorie deprivation without your having to deprive yourself. The cellular workers consume the older, weaker cell parts and the cells that are no longer dividing, and also probably some cells that might even turn into cancer if they're left in there because they're damaged. So you get all the benefits of fasting by using this stuff. And in the case of a 2014 study on dogs, they found that the drug showed signs of younger hearts and reversed age-related cardiac issues. In 2014, there was a study done by Novartis and researchers at Stanford, published in Science Translational Medicine. They gave the drug to older people for 6 weeks, and they watched their immunity. This was essentially a phase one safety trial. They gave it to them because, you know what this drug is primarily used for? It's used to prevent organ rejection. And people who are transplant patients typically take a couple of milligrams a day to prevent organ transplants from rejecting. Well, if it's an immunosuppressant, do we want to be giving it to people? So they used older volunteers because they wanted to use people who were vulnerable, and they gave the drug to them. And actually, they saw an increase in their immunity at a dose of 0.5 milligrams a day or 5 milligrams a week. So you could just take 5 milligrams a week in contrast to the 10 milligrams a week that the transplant people were taking at 2 milligrams a day. Probably taking it once a week has a different benefit. That needs to be studied. So rapamycin has, amongst the movers and the shakers of Silicon Valley, who don't want to die, they're really liking this life, and they would happily upload into a computer if that's what it took to stay alive, because they're masters of the universe, and they want to stay that way. There's a big fad for this stuff, and people are prescribing it. I think it is not a best practice at this point, but there are whole practices that do nothing but injecting stem cells and giving out rapamycin and human growth hormone and a whole bunch of other kind of dodgy things. Of the things that are being used this way, I think low-dose rapamycin probably is safer. I think keeping your calories down and eating 80% of what your calculated rate should be. And you calculate that by looking at your basal metabolic rate and looking at how much you exercise. And there are algorithms on the web that you can look at that will give you that number. Now, we're going to take a moment and dive pretty deep. If you really, really want to see something funny, you'll look at the fact that while it's given as a drug for anti-organ rejection, this rapamycin also has a benefit in cancer. People with various types of carcinoma, when given rapamycin, show growth inhibition of their cancer. It's very clear that overeating and the fact that people who do overeat and consume excess calories have higher cancer rates, that there may be a connection here between all of these factors. I was going to give you a laugh. If you Google mTOR, Wikipedia will deliver to you something called the P13K/AKT/ mTOR pathway. And I just want you to look at the drawing, okay? The drawing is hilarious. It is a rat's nest of feedback loops and suppression and stimulation. And it just, I look at this stuff all the time. And I want to print this on a t-shirt just to amaze my friends and surprise my enemies, because it is craziness. But if you look at this diagram, you'll see mTOR is a key actor on so much cellular signaling that maybe these rapamycin people who are taking it every day have a point. Certainly, I think that microdoses of a drug can have very different effects, as we've already talked about with the LDN. So I'm not entirely against this, but I'd rather see people do calorie restriction with a multivitamin than play around with something that is at least potentially, if your body processes it differently, going to suppress your immune system during the time of COVID. So I'm not advocating you go out and buy yourself some rapamycin. I do think it's interesting, and particularly how these pathways are tied together in these surprising and, you know, somewhat counterintuitive ways. We're going to talk about a common class of drugs that yet another study has linked to an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. And this was first published a few years ago. It was a retrospective correlation study from the British National Health Service. They, of course, give out prescription drugs, and antihistamines and sleeping pills in England are tracked because they're part of the National Health Service. They noticed an interesting correlation between ever use and amount of lifetime use of anticholinergic drugs. Well, what is an anticholinergic drug? Anticholinergic drugs are widely used for dozens of conditions, and some of these require prescription, some are available over the counter. In England, what they saw was a correlation between the ones that they were tracking, which is to say sleeping pills, including antihistamines that were used for sleeping pills, bladder drugs, and I'll come back to that in a moment, and antihistamines. They found that there were more people with Alzheimer's and cognitive decline who used these agents or had them prescribed and then refilled them. That was the English study. This one's new. This study looked at cognitively normal study participants who were taking at least one anticholinergic drug, and they followed them over a period of time, up to 10 years. They looked at, did they develop any cognitive impairment? And what they found was that if you took at least one of these drugs, you were 47% more likely, 1.5 times more likely, in other words, to develop mild cognitive impairment. It was a big enough study, powered, I think, reasonably well, 688 adults, and it was prospective. So that's important when you're looking at quality of science. We weren't looking back. We were taking people, trying to, you know, just randomly assign them to one group or the other. Well, in this case, are you taking the drug? 1/3 were taking them, and the ones who were taking them were taking about 4 of them, which was very surprising to me. They also found that if you had any of the genetic markers for Alzheimer's disease and you were taking anticholinergic drugs, you were 4 times more likely to develop this mild cognitive impairment than people without the biomarkers. So if you have if you've done your 23andMe and you have an APOE4, you need to stay away from these drugs. People with genetic risk were 2 to 4 times more likely. Alzheimer's biomarkers, by the way, the group that was 4 times more likely, these are things that you pick up in the brain, usually in the central nervous system, and it shows that the person has problems with acetylcholine. So if you give a drug that's an anticholinergic, it makes sense that it would make them worse. Another problem is that the older you are, the longer it takes you to metabolize these drugs. And unfortunately, they generally are taken at higher levels because the problem is greater. So 57% of people taking the drugs were actually taking more than they should have been taking based on recommendations for their age. So I guess you're slavering to hear what I'm talking about. Let me give you a list of anticholinergic drugs. If you have any of these conditions, you are very likely to have been given them. Urinary incontinence, overactive bladder, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. That sounds like a big swath of the population. They're often used in Parkinson's disease to block certain kinds of movements. One of the big ones is atropine. And atropine, you can have itropropium, which is Atrovent. This is a chemical analog of atropine. It's also anticholinergic. A big one, oxybutynin, ditropan, that's used for an overactive bladder. There are Urispaz, that's overactive bladder. Dicyclamine, that's used for irritable bowel and bowel spasm. There are many drugs here. Scopolamine, that's one that people use for seasickness. Put that little patch behind your ear. Well, gee, maybe you're also doing a little damage to your brain. This is correlation, and it's predictive correlation. Let's see any other drugs. Ditrol, another bladder drug. Spiriva, tiotropium, that's another inhaler. And of course, Benadryl, and all of the antihistamine-like sleeping drugs. So you really have to be careful about these smooth muscle drugs. And if you have risk factors, or if you already feel like you're having cognitive problems, you're going to need to go find something else. If you've got allergies and you're trying to treat that, then take a look at monolucast or Singulair and nasal steroids. If you have an overactive bladder, first of all, Kegel exercises every day, no matter what, because when you get that sphincter muscle or that pelvic floor muscle strong, you can actually trigger a relaxation of the bladder muscle reflexively. So you can trigger relaxation. You can overcome, oddly enough, your bladder by using the same exercise that helps with urinary incontinence. So learn to do Kegels, learn to do them well if this is your issue. I no longer use these drugs in my patients because of this research and the fact that I don't want to be responsible for giving people something that is treating a lifestyle issue and giving them a devastating disability to treat a lifestyle inconvenience. We've got time for one quick story. And this one is, all right, I'm going to violate the prohibition just because it was cool. Antiviral used to treat cat coronavirus also works against SARS-CoV-2. Turns out there's a deadly disease in cats caused by a coronavirus. And researchers had been working and had developed a protease inhibitor that interferes with the virus's ability to replicate. Therefore, that race between virus and immune system, well, hamstring the virus and you get to win the race. This protease inhibitor was developed, it was first discovered actually when they were looking for drugs to treat SARS-1 or SARS, back before we knew there'd be a 2, and they found this protease inhibitor, but it never really got any boost until it was discovered that it worked in animals. So now it's like, oh, interferes with coronavirus. Let's try it in tissue culture. So human tissue culture and animal models, virus in test tubes, human cell lines. So you know what? Seems to work. They've done the 3D crystalline structure of it. It works. It's available. They can make it, and it has a different action than remdesivir. Possibly the two could act synergistically. They certainly wouldn't step on each other. More to come, I'm sure, on this front. I hope you've enjoyed the program. I hope that you are practicing social distancing, wearing your mask. And this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.